moral degeneration, the decadent lifestyle, materialistic, totally self-absorbed, obsessed, egocentric lifestyle that he saw in his society. He was looking for a superior, more profound lifestyle, and he was not happy with the lifestyle that he witnessed in his society. So in that process of meditation, in that process of moments of silence, in fact weeks, months of silence that he observed, away from his wife and his family and his society, one day Archangel Gabriel was sent by God with a revelation. The revelation was, and I want you to note that Muhammad did not know how to read or write at all. He was completely illiterate. However, the first revelation to reveal to Muhammad was read. He came back to his society and he told people, "Oh my people, God has sent his angel Gabriel to me and chosen me as a prophet. And he has sent his first commandment, and that is to read." There could not have been a more self-deprecating command than the first command itself. Muhammad did not know how to read or write, and yet he's telling his society, God has given him the first command which says read. God has his own wisdom, and Muhammad delivered his message quite profoundly to his society. So Islam and education became integral part of human journey. It is said that you can't discover God unless you are educated. You can't discover yourself unless you're educated. Prophet Muhammad said once that the sleep of a learned person is more superior than the entire night's worship of an uneducated person. Giving more importance to education, enlightenment, thinking, reflecting, the science of our progress. So that's what feeds every child to be taught from the day they're born, principles of faith, principles of life. So I have two children. As soon as they were born, my preoccupation became, how can I be the best educator, father, inspiration for my children? And the first thing I learned is, for them to learn, I need to change. They will not learn from my words, but they will learn from my practices, what I do. If I smoke and I tell my children not to smoke, it's very likely that they'll just laugh at me. If I tell them not to lie and I lie, if I tell them not to cheat and I cheat, if I tell them to keep to time and I don't keep to time, if I tell them not to sleep too much and I sleep all the time, if I'm lazy and tell them not to be lazy, it's not going to work. So I had to change myself. That transformation was the first and most important principle in my view, and still stands as the most important principle in the Muslim society about teaching children. Religious education or any education must begin from the parents by practicing what they preach. More. Number two, we are taught that children and the lives of our children can be divided up into three parts. From the age of zero till the age of seven, their brain is like a sponge. It absorbs anything and everything that comes their way. So give them information, as much information as possible. Don't worry about explaining most of it. Information, information, information. Their brain cannot have information overload. It can just absorb. So when I was teaching my children, I was teaching them the words of the Quran. Not necessarily the meaning, just the words. The moral teachings of the Prophet. Life skills. Ability to read and write. Our children speak 5 languages now. The eldest one is 9. The youngest one is 6. So we've given them information, as much as we possibly could, humanly muster. Between the ages of 7 and 14, it's the time for building rationale, capacity to think, process information, come up with reasons. So the advice we have from Islamic tradition is give them rationale and reasons for those years between the ages of 7 and 14. It's when they become a good child, a child who will become delinquent later on, a child who may be troubled in their lives later on, unless you give them the reasons and parameters. Rationale. This is when they gain why they're doing, and that's when they ask why constantly without stopping. And then between the ages of 14 and until they die or you die, become their best friend. And this is the teaching of our Islam again, to be with them as their best friend. So Islamic education system is based on some of those principles. Teaching kids principles, rationale, and friendship. We also base our religious teachings on morals and manners a lot. Morals and manners become the most important cornerstone of Islamic education. So for example, we all do it with our children, how to eat. In Islam, we eat with our right hand, not with the left hand. And I've often seen this problem in school. I'm holding my fork on my right hand and the knife on my left hand. And all my school teachers are saying, no, that's wrong. And I'm telling them, thank you very much for telling me it's wrong. That's right according to Islam. According to you, it's wrong, but my tradition says I must hold it with my right hand. Teaching them, our children, those profound knowledge, even though they're different. Teaching our children how to clean themselves. In Islam, when we go to the bathroom, we have to wash ourselves with water. Not just tissue, but water. So it becomes imperative in the lives of children, hygiene from the day they're born. So we just don't teach them, we practice with them. How they should and how they shouldn't. How should they greet each other? Our teaching is, Assalamu alaikum, may peace be upon you. As soon as I open the door of my house, I am the loudest unless they're asleep. By saying a big greeting. And if they don't respond, I complain. I just greeted you, I have not responded, I have not heard anything. Why is your miserable today? Becomes a point of conversation. So teaching them how to have those social skills, to meet people. How not to waste food is taught at home. God says, eat and drink and don't be wasteful. So there is a saying of the Prophet, and that is, the last bite on your plate contains the biggest amount of blessings from God. So we teach our children, oh my God, the last bite. Who's going to have it first? In fact, I sometimes jump on their plate. And they will fight with me, no, Daddy, that's my bite. No, I want the blessings. No, I want the blessings. That competition to create a moral imperative within them so that they don't become wasteful later on. These are ways in which we teach our children. Not just by talking, but by practicing ourselves and with them. Morals and manners. Qul akhlaq in Islam. Very, very important. In fact, the Prophet himself said, whole of religion is good character. The entire religion of Islam is good character. So, I would say, suggest, if you are, accept my suggestion, if you are teaching children about Christianity, not just teach them theology, but teach them the practices by you practicing it first. So that they see it manifesting itself in the society, in the world around. So that's my approach, our approach to Islamic education. I know I said a lot more than I wanted to, but I said it because I thought it would provide a good basis for a discussion for later.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to hear, and I agree with you that almost becoming an idol for your kids in a positive way is kind of learning them education and Christian or religious education. At the same time, I think I'm kind of thinking how can we get them a kind of affiliation to the mosque or to the church and to the religion that I love. How can we make them think that I belong here? This is my home, my second home, my place to be, where I have my friends, where I can learn, where I can pray and things like that. That's a challenge sometimes in Norway, for instance. Mm.
Somebody said to me, so let me just clarify this. I preach at four different mosques in a rota, monthly rota. So in each month I'm in one mosque. Over 4 weeks I'm in different mosques. So there's a joke that I have four wives already. My four mosques, just so that you know. And my wife is actually somebody who doesn't come in that equation. Maximum I'm allowed, in quote unquote, is four, no more. But you know, it's important to make that clarity from the day one when you begin your journey in life. The reason why children find mosques or church or religious teaching dull and unexciting is perhaps because they don't find fun and excitement in their parents, in their educators, in the way it's been taught. And I would hate to teach children religious education that would numb their brain. Rather, I would like them to be stimulated enough to find it exhilarating, find it amazing. So I keep telling them stories. That's all I do. And I have known with the children to be a good storyteller, actually an animated storyteller. My daughter is very challenging. She is unbelievable. You know, talking about children, they mimic their parents. They copy their parents, absolutely in everything. If you see my daughter, my facial gesture, the way I speak, the way I move my mouth when I'm speaking, she is a photocopy of it. She even looks like me, more so. She's a whiter version. My wife is Hungarian, so white, and I'm brown Bangladeshi. She looks like me, but she has taken her mother's skin pigmentation, so white, but is absolutely like me. And that scares me, because sometimes when I see her doing things, which I do, and I say, oh my God, I shouldn't be doing this, because she's doing it, that worries me often. So teaching children your religion should be a fun thing. I tell them stories all the time. One day she said to me, Daddy, she said to me, I'm disappointed in you. I said, why? She goes, you have not given me Charles Dickens to read. I said, how old are you? She goes, I'm five. I said, but five, that's too young. She goes, well, Matilda, in a book, has read Charles Dickens when she was four. And I'm five, you have not given me Charles Dickens. I said, go downstairs in the library room and you will see two sets of Charles Dickens. One set is yours, darling, you can have it. She goes, okay. She went downstairs, being stubborn, picked up one of those books and brought it to her own room. And she read Charles Dickens' first chapter, Tales of the Two Cities. And of course, I asked her afterward, what did you understand? She goes, nothing. I said, but you have read it. She goes, I told you I would read it, so I've read it. Well, you have not understood anything. No. She goes, but you have to read it to me. I said, okay. So both my children are sitting on their bed, and I'm standing there acting out Charles Dickens. And as you know, Charles Dickens, if you read it, is not a story to be read. It's to be acted out completely. Your hands, your body, your face, everything must move with it. And they were captivated. They didn't move from their bed for as long as I was speaking. So storytelling is a very powerful tool, and it must be told in the most animated way for children if you are to impart the religious teachings and your morals. That's the reason why I've gone into television. We have started a TV station online where we will be investing a huge amount of our money in animation and cartoon that contains moral principles, not just the Spider-Man and Superman, not just the Incredible Hulk and all the rest of it. No, we're not talking about superheroes. We're talking about morals. To me, morals are things that you learn, and superheroes don't exist. I don't want to create fantasy and get the children to have that phantom world in their head. I want them to have the real world of morality. Current cartoon series, I don't like them at all. They teach how to be violent. Bugs Bunny gets killed 20 million times and he rises again. Roadrunner is about constant accident. Donald Duck is being stupid and silly. To me, what morality do we teach our children showing those Hollywood cartoons and the Disney World cartoons? I don't believe we show them sufficient or morality that would help them later on in life. So we have chosen ourselves to move away from that, and we will, in the next 10 years, invest, if not thousands, millions of pounds in creating animation that has religious and moral teaching, but fun. And the last thing for how we make the children love God, love religion, is by showing that we love it ourselves. I love God. What does it really mean in my life? How does God make my life any different? I often contemplate over it. In our house, we have often called thinking time, sitting down and having a thought. So my son said the other day something very profound. He said, "Dad," I said, "Yes." Actually, he said to his mother, "Mom," I said, the mommy said, "Yes, I died when I was born. I am only living my dreams today. And I'll be born again when I'm dead." He's five. My wife looked at him saying, "What? Where did you get that from?" We've been thinking about it. We've been thinking about it. That comes from a deep process of thinking for him. Where it came from, what it means, we will never know. He will explain later on in life. But to give those children space to think, more than a pair of trainers and the Nintendo games, is what's missing in our lives today. We have banned TV in our home. No TV. We don't give them iPad, iPhone to play with unless it's, you know, time framed. So they use their time to read more, write more, be more creative. And I'm so grateful to my dad, my father. He never had television in his house for all his children as they were growing up. Has it made me any less? In fact, no. I work in television industry. And I have never seen a TV, or I've never had a TV until I turned 26. When I had my own house, I bought my first TV. So I don't think we will miss out anything if we create that space for children, where they can understand their inner spirituality without the material constant destruction. I call material a destruction from spirituality for children. Undue influence on them. If you expose them too much to material, don't be surprised if they become too materialistic. If you want spirituality for your children, try and reduce the influence of material that are around. Get them to appreciate life. My sister lives in Czech Republic. She sends her child to a school in the forest. It's called the Forest School. Every time I go to them and I go to pick him up, he is covered head to toe in mud and rubbish. I call him the Tarzan, the joke. His life is all about living from the earth. I think that's an amazing concept, to bring up children like that who are not dependent on material. They're not allowed plastic. Can you imagine? They're not allowed plastic. I think it's a great thing. I recently found out plastic is responsible for a lot of trouble for men. I don't know that you know. It contains a lot of estrogen in plastic. Estrogen is feminine hormone. And the more a man is exposed to plastic, the more estrogen his body takes. And more estrogen a man's body takes, the more female hormone we have. And the more feminine we become. I don't want to become too feminine. I want to have some femininity within me, but I want to keep masculinity alive. As an example of how material around us can be very corrupting, we need to go back to some sort of normality in nature. And that's what's missing, even in our relationship with God. And I'm suggesting that we create a rebalancing approach where children are connected with nature, therefore God. How many of our children know that chicken actually is an animal that is alive, and chicken breast that you bring home comes from a living creature? How many of our children have felt a live chicken on their hand and they could feel the pulse of the chicken and the warmth of the chicken, and when they sat down around their table to eat that chicken breast, they know that chicken breast came from a living chicken. Spirituality is gone a long time ago if there is no relationship between where things come from and how it ends up on your table. I want us to regain that ground. I took my children to a chicken farm. and I slaughtered a chicken in front of them. You may say, how barbaric. You can say what you like. The liberal of our world can say what they like. I really don't care. My children now know how to respect an animal. Never to abuse an animal, because they know an animal has been killed for their survival. In other words, an animal has given up its life to keep me alive. You should be humbled by that. So it's about getting children to connect with nature so they can connect with God. It's about getting children to understand where they come from so they can connect with God. It's about making education fun. It's about making spirituality exciting. If we could do that, I think we'd have children, as well as the animals.
It makes me think about, we just have a big festival here now with youngsters celebrating and having a confirmant teaching and practicing weekend. And one of the young kids, he actually he's thinking about something about things you now mentioned, and he said, if we know more about God, we know more about ourselves. And I think he was right. And I think this is the great opening knew the secret of something that is important. When we know more about the life and how to treat the world, we know more about God and more about ourselves. But at the same time, I think that religious education in Norway is often very secular. And we are in one kind expecting a full respect for all kind of religions. That's a fine thing. But at the same time, we are building walls between several religions, and we are speaking about them and us. They are doing this and that, and we are doing this and that. How can we build down these walls and look? Use the ladder to climb these walls and participate in each other's and be part of questions like you are asking and try to fulfill all these dreams for the kids.
That's a very challenging question, actually. How do we build bridges? How do we bring communities together? We need safe space in which we can interrupt. Safe space where we can sit down and talk about ourselves. Safe space where we can be who we want to be authentic about ourselves. I was sharing a story yesterday with the group in IFC's office that I was traveling on the plane, and I sat down, and as normally I do when I sit on the plane, I know this plane is going to take off, and I'm not sure if it's going to land. When I'm on the earth, I'm firm, but up there, there's no guarantee. A small bird can fly into the wings, into the engine, and make it collapse. Anything can happen. So as a man of faith, I resort to reading my Quran, God's word. So I took my phone out, as I normally do, and I opened up the app that has got the Quran, and I was reading. Right next to me was a couple. And I saw him looking at my phone with the side of his eyes, and I saw his face change. He saw on my Quran, Arabic writing, a brown man with a beard is about to read, oh my God, what's going to happen? He nudged his wife with his elbow. She looked as well, and both of them were looking very scared. They're looking very scared of me reading the Quran. What were they scared of? They've seen too many Hollywood movies. Yes. Where the terrorists read the Quran before they blow up the bomb, blow up the plane. They've heard too many newspaper stories that is what Muslims do. And I now have become associated by default by their thinking and the TV program they've seen. So I said to myself, you know what, I'm frightening this speech. But I also want to be authentic to myself. But I know I'm frightened. How can I do this? So I instantly turned from the Arabic to English, what I was reading. There's a translation. And I gave the phone over to the gentleman and the lady. I said, here, this is what I'm reading if you're scared. I know you're frightened because I'm reading the Quran in Arabic. I know you've seen too many Hollywood movies to see the connection. Please read the English language of what I'm reading. I'm asking for God's grace in my journey. I'm asking for God's help in all of us so that we can land safely. I'm asking for God to help me so that I can strengthen my weakness. And I'm asking for God's help so that I'm not frightened of flying. Kindly please read and see what I'm reading. They both looked at me. They didn't read what I gave them. They laughed and they smiled at me. I had diffused their fear. And then we had a 3-hour conversation all the way until we landed. About everything, from our children to holidays. And I found out that they own a holiday. So they own a hotel. And they invited me to go to their hotel to stay one day. So I believe building or bridging the gap, building those bridges require you and I to start understanding one another, getting to know one another, becoming familiar with the other. Who is the other? What are you so afraid of? What are you so afraid of? Why do Muslims and Islam frighten so many people? Why? Do I know enough about Islam? Do I actually know enough about the religion? Or am I being prejudiced and colored by the images that I see on television? Television that I don't always trust to be telling the truth, or if telling the truth, objective truth. And yet, 80% of the world's population learn about Islam from the media. So I want us to start thinking about the other. And the Muslims the same. Thinking about their non-Muslim neighbors. Find out about your non-Muslim neighbors. Read, make relationships, build bridges. And second example I want to give you is my mother's example. My mother used to live in an area predominantly Jewish in London. But both of the neighbors on each side of my mother's house were non-Jewish. One elderly English lady and one young couple. After living in that house for 5 years, my mother decided that she needs to move further. So she asked me to help her to move, and I, being the eldest son, hired a big massive truck, loaded all her goods and moved them as you do. And as we were leaving the house finally, her neighbor next door was standing on her door. She was standing on the door. And she was crying her eyes out. My mother doesn't speak English. Zero, doesn't speak any English. The lady next door doesn't speak any Bengali. Mother doesn't speak English and she doesn't speak Bengali. So I went up to her and I said to her, Lisa, why are you crying when my mother is leaving? My mother doesn't speak English and you don't speak Bengali. You never had a conversation ever. She said to me, Ajmal, yes, I don't speak Bengali and your mother doesn't speak English, I know. But language of love doesn't need words. And she said to me, I'll miss your mother dearly. I said to her, but how did you develop that relationship with her? I still don't know how she did it, how my mother did it. If we bridge the gap that we have between us and our neighbors, we'll have done the most important bridge building that you can think of. And the last and the final one. Our children go to schools and they play with their friends, Muslims, Christians, Jews, people of faith and no faith. They don't distinguish between what friend they have, what color that friend's skin is, what ethnic background they come from, or what religion they hold. Children don't discriminate. Children are innocent, and children are predisposed of the best natural instincts that humanity needs to survive. If our children don't discriminate and do not hesitate in building bridges, why do we? Why do we? What will I lose if I build a bridge with our neighbor, with my neighbor, with my neighborhood, with my society, even if somebody is different to me? So what if my neighbor is Christian? So what if my community is Muslim? So what if my local place of worship is a church or a synagogue or a mosque? So what? My mother-in-law is Christian. And I'm Muslim. And you would wonder, what kind of a relationship would I have with such a mother-in-law? Exactly the same relationship as you would have if your mother-in-law was of the same faith and same background. I know this because I was married before. It's my second marriage. My first marriage failed in unfortunate divorce. My mother-in-law was a Muslim. The same jokes, same banter, same laughter, same hospitality, same upset, same joy, same tears as before, as with my Christian mother. Ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, we're the same when it comes to our humanity. We're exactly the same. I don't see any difference between anyone of any faith or no faith. Faith gives you and me an operating parameter, a framework, but it must be a more empowering reason for you and I to build closer relationship with people who are around us. So building bridges requires us to understand one another, requires us to share our humanity with one another, requires us to break the doors and barriers of building the immediate bridge, which is our bridge of the neighbors. And it requires you and I to rise above, like our children have risen above, and ask ourselves, what am I going to lose if I build a bridge with those people who are different around me? What will I lose?
Thank you. We'll have the possibility to catch up your breath now. I can tell you that if someone has any questions, it will be able to ask them in a while. But we're moving on to another topic. Yesterday I saw a nice program on TV. It was a Norwegian comedian, Linn Skåber, and a journalist named Harald Stanghelle. They were locked into an elevator, and there they should sit and talk about religion. About among all the topics they were talking about, the religion was one of them. And this journalist asked this comedian, I know that you believe in God, you're a Christian, but I never heard that you have told that in public. Is it so that in a secular world, religion has become more and more a private thing, a private belief, a private understanding that we're not going to bother anyone else? Because her answer was that I don't want to go public with my religion because I'm afraid someone should think that I am an extremist, that I'm conservative, that I'm one of the stupid believers, if you understand what I mean. Is the secular world a challenge in this way, do you think? You and I, we are safe in our religion and we are faithful and things like that, but some people are afraid to go public with their religious thoughts just because they got some marks on them. Okay, extremist, you are stupid, you are right. What do you think?
See, a pet subject I have. Just like we have religious extremists in the world, we also have secular extremists in the world. And extremism from every background, every angle, is problem. Or are problematic for the world. No extremism is good for anybody. Whether it is religious or secular, I don't care. So I want us all to stand together and condemn all types of extremism, whether perpetrated by individuals based on religion, or secularism, or state that perpetrate them in our name, extremism must be condemned across the board. That's number one. Number two, I can't separate my religion and my public life. I'm sorry, I can't. When I step out into the public world, I stood in the last parliamentary election in the UK, 2010. And I told the world that I'm standing, I'm motivated by my religion to stand at the service of humanity, at the service of the locality that I believe I could serve well. But I am not going to impose my religious belief or ideals on anybody. But I'm still inspired by my religion to stand. I became second in that election. I didn't win. And a lot of people who voted for me, they voted for me because I was open about my faith and I was open about my intentions and ambitions in my political life. And I'm still very political when it comes to my life. If you look me up, you'll see I do a lot of political activities. This election I'm not standing because I'm too busy with my television station. Otherwise I would have stood in this election that is only a few days away in the UK. So I want us to know that I want you to know that you cannot separate your religion and your religiosity from politics. You can't. If religion was banished into the side tracks, the back streets, underground movement, that would be a problem. Religion must have the same right to interact in the wider world. Yesterday's the big Christian newspaper, I don't know the name of it, published a survey in which it found that a majority of the Norwegian people that they surveyed do not like the idea of offending anyone. We don't want to offend anyone. And the second thing they said in that particular survey was quite interesting, is that majority of Norwegians would like to see religion having space in the public domain rather than be a private thing. So majority of Norwegians want religion to become public. There is a difference between a neutral space, which is a state, and religion being in public. In a neutral space, that is the state itself, all religions must be public. I say even more, I say we should create a free market for religions so that they can compete with one another, healthy competition. There's nothing wrong with Muslims becoming Christians if they want to. There's nothing wrong with Christians becoming Muslims if they want to. There's nothing wrong if somebody wants to become Jewish or Hindu. It's up to them, it's people's choice. Who am I to impose any of my views on you? But there should be a healthy environment to compete. I should have the right to compete with my fellow Christians, and fellow Christians have the same right to compete with me. And that can only happen if religion has a space, or religions have space in public. And the third thing I believe, religions should and has the right to, is to influence the morals and the ethics that govern our day-to-day living. Why shouldn't it? If it wasn't for religion, many morals that we still have as morals would go out through the window and would become obsolete. And I'm very proud and very happy that religion plays a moderating role in the world. I believe if religions weren't there, greed would proliferate. Everybody wants to become greedy, amass as much wealth as possible, become the richest person in the world. If religion wasn't there, ego would become the center of everything that we do. I want to become famous. I don't care what you are and who you are. I will become famous at any cost. Greed and ego, two of the most antitheses to religion and spirituality that you can think of. Without religion, these would be like wild animals taking over our society and destroying everything that we stand for. Because of religion, we still have some respect still left for family and family values. I believe because of religion. Imagine a world without religion. There would be, in my view, no strong families left. And that to me is very dangerous. That would be the self-destruct button I would press to bring the world to an end very soon. And finally, no religion means no accountability from your conscience. Religion teaches me to refine my conscience because there is somebody superior called God who is watching me 24 hours a day. That conscience drives me to become better. If you are a humanist, please don't tell me your conscience isn't driven by something. Your conscience is driven by something. Fear of the law. Fear of being caught by the camera if you're speeding. That conscience always has to be there in order for us to remain what I call upright. So religion must never be banished to private space. It must always remain a public domain, in the public domain. But there is a difference. Should any religion have the right to impose its own way on everybody? No, it shouldn't. Religion, by definition, is a choice. I choose to be a Muslim. I was born in a Muslim family, I know. But consciously I chose to remain and practice my faith to the much or amount I do is a conscious choice. So to answer your question, don't be afraid of your religious identity. Those who try and banish you to the obsolete space of private, please challenge them. Why should I not have a view? Just because I believe in God? God may become redundant in the eyes of the secular world, but in my eyes, God is still alive and fully functioning and in control of the world. Look, I can give you a bigger challenge than that, and I said this yesterday. When we are in our stomach, when we are in our mother's stomach, in their womb, when we are in this form of a fetus, the entire fetus is not formed, it's just a leech-like object in the womb of the mother. No organs have developed yet. A black dot appears in the middle of the organ, that fetus. And at a certain time, in the middle of everything, when there is no brain function, there is no brain in existence in that fetus, that black dot turns into a heart and starts pumping. We are told, without the brain, the heart can't function. And yet the heart begins functioning before the brain is developed. What happened? What caused the heart to come to life? No scientist yet has been able to give you and I a definitive answer as to what happens to the fetus, that it starts pumping blood and heart starts functioning without the existence of brain. I know because I believe. You know because you believe. We believe God breathes into the fetus his spirit, and that's what keeps it alive. In Islam, we call it the ruh, the spirit. When that goes, I'm dead. Is ruh quantifiable? Is it empirical that I can feel it, touch it, measure it? No. And yet, because of that, I live. Denying that means denying myself. So those who profess to be more clever, more modern, more scientific than the ones who are religious, my challenge to you is, please tell me, what is that spirit? Please tell me, what is that spirit? If you know what that spirit is, I'll follow your way. I don't want to go into that confrontation with you. I want equal space in the world. Don't banish me in the periphery, because I belong just like you do. To me, that's how I strongly feel. Religion must have a space, and it's not a private space.
It's very nice to listen to you, and I think you now also answered the question about religious education, because what you said in the beginning, that we are role models for our children, that's important also in this issue, I think. That we stand forward and actually take our stand and have respect to each other in faith and in common belief. You have a very very long program this Norway trip, but yesterday you were speaking about values, Muslim values and Islam. And Christian and Muslims, we meet in faith. We do believe. And one of the main challenges may be how do we meet the secular world? You have said something about it now, but how can and what values can Islam contribute to the Norwegian society? Can you please give us some thoughts about that?
I can. I spoke about 7 values, and I luckily have the notes with me. The seven values that I talked about in my speech yesterday, value number one is faith in one God. Value number two, purity of heart. Value number three, clean character. Value number four, humility. Value number five, moderation. Value number six, compassion. And seven, honesty. Those are intrinsic values of Islam, but not only for Islam, but for everybody. They're available in Christianity, in Judaism, in religions outside the Abrahamic triangle. They exist across the board. They don't only exist in Islam. But when I talk about them, and when my Christian friends see, oh, hang on a second, we're talking about the same value, it makes my contribution and your contribution so much easier, and more importantly, it makes it non-competitive, more harmonious, and we are able to see one another as equal. So, faith in one God. Islam is very clear. There's only one God. Unambiguous. Unafraid. Unashamed about it. One God. No partner. Nothing. And in which we differ with Christianity slightly. God doesn't have a son. Doesn't have a daughter. Has no wife. Nothing. The only difference between Christianity and Islam is the position of Jesus, by the way. There is no other difference in morality and lessons of life. The only position is that one. So first moral value that Muslims can bring, or would bring, is the value of believing in one God. Purity of heart. If my heart is not clean, there is a problem. There is a saying of the Prophet who says, there is a small flesh of meat in your body. If that's diseased, the entire body is diseased. Both physically as well as spiritually. If our heart is not well, we are not well. It is said, our heart and its beat is in sync with remembrance of God all the time. And if we are not feeding our heart, we're in trouble. Clean character, morality, as I talked to you about before. Muslims have to focus on character, character, character building. Humility is essential part of our faith, as opposed to being arrogant and proud. So not egocentric, but humble. Humble about everything. Moderation in everything. Not too much worship of God, not too much fasting, not too much praying, not too much, nothing too much. Everything must be in moderation. There is a saying of the Prophet which says, "And God has a right over you, your body has a right over you, and your family has a right over you." The Prophet said, when you eat, you should divide your stomach into three parts. Eat one third full with food, eat one third full with water or drinks, and keep one third empty for air. We tend to have a bad habit of eating complete first, wait for half an hour for the air to come, and then another half an hour to be able to perhaps drink. It's completely in contradiction, and moderation will keep us healthy. And I tell you, I'm an example of how I have maintained one level of weight. I went to see my doctor 2 weeks ago, and he looked at my weight, and he looked at my weight 10 years ago. He goes to me, it's remarkable, Ajmal. You were exactly the same 10 years ago as today in terms of your weight. How have you done it? I said to him, doctor, it's a very simple equation. I eat one third full with solid, one third with liquid, and I keep one third of my stomach empty. He goes, wow, where do you get that from? I said, that's what my Prophet told me. In fact, the 5-2 diet that was introduced in America, that you eat 5 days and fast 2 days, is the practice of Prophet Muhammad. He used to fast Mondays and Thursdays. Every Monday and Thursday, in his entire life, he would fast. And everybody knows about this, it's recorded. And the doctor who introduced it said, I read it from the life of the Prophet, that he would fast 2 days and eat 5 days, and I researched, and I thought that's been fantastic, it makes sense. So, moderation in everything, that's the essence of the value. Compassion. I talked about compassion at length yesterday. And I'll tell you again, we have an economy that is based on greed. We have an economy that is based on selfishness. We have an economy that is based on my need, my need, my need. I want us to champion a new type of economy, and it's called compassionate capitalism. If you bring compassion into capitalism, capitalism will die. Because compassion and capitalism can't exist in the same room. And I want the capitalistic ideals to end and compassionate capitalism to take over. So I care about my neighbor. I share my wealth. I'm not just not greed driven. Compassion in my humanity, compassion with my friends. And I was very touched when I saw you guys were giving donations as we were coming in to those two people who were begging. I don't support begging because I think that debilitates people. But still, you give. That's your duty and you've done. There's the saying of the Prophet where he says, the hand that gives is better than the hand that receives. So discouraging begging, but also encouraging giving at the same time. I love this idea of compassion shared between churches, mosques, synagogues, equally because it is an intrinsic part of our faith. Honesty in the final one. If I can't be honest about myself with you, if you are afraid of me, if you are afraid of my faith, then there is a problem. If I'm afraid of you and your faith, then there is a problem. So honesty in everything. Honesty is what builds all religion. And Prophet Muhammad again said, the entire religion of Islam is based on honesty. Honest with God. Honest with your family, with my wife, my children. Honest with my neighbors. Honest with everybody. Honesty in everything. Whether it is to do with paying taxes or to keeping our streets clean. Whether to do with anything that I hide from my wife or my husband, or to do with the way we treat our children. So honesty is the other one. So these are the seven common values. But I thought those common values, since they're Islamic, I might as well claim them first, so we can see the commonality between us, in order to build better bridges and more dialogue.
Before we open for some questions, I would like to go into something in this stance in this brochure that we have got from Initiative of Change, and there's a statement here that you have said that Islam is a religion of peace, has a vital role to play in making peace in the world today. The Blessed Prophet once said, spread peace. But at the same time, we can take a look at the world today, and this is a big question, and we see that it's absolutely no peace all over the place. And we know that the Christians have not been good all the time. And now some parts of the world, the Muslims, have some problems to solve. And the media in the Western are focusing very remarkable on these things, what happens in the Middle East, for instance. How can we meet these issues and tragedies with faithful belief and try to make peace in this world?
This is probably the most difficult question of the afternoon. And this probably will also make you uncomfortable. Are you following me? My answer will make you uncomfortable. And I say sorry before I start. Not because I want to insult you or upset you, just because I'm going to be speaking the truth and I'll be speaking my mind. And I'm known for that. Muslim world today has no freedom. When I say Muslim world, I mean countries where Muslims are majority. There is no freedom. There is no democracy. There is no rule of law. There are no legitimate governments. There are no independent judiciaries. There is very little accountability. And there is no economic prospect for prosperity or happiness. That's the reality of the Muslim world today. When I say the Muslim world, what am I talking about? I'm talking about countries from Indonesia to sub-Saharan Africa. If you are honest about those countries, you cannot name me one country from the Muslim majority countries which has one legitimate government. You can't name me a single one, except perhaps Turkey. Turkey has come a long way in its quest to become more democratic. It is in a transition, but it is the closest we have to a democratic norm compared to any other country in the Muslim world. Second country that is trying is Tunisia, with lots of troubles and turmoils, recent Arab Spring began with Tunisia. It hasn't finished with Tunisia, and we pray it doesn't, because they have got a constitution, they've got a government, they're doing good, they're slowly developing infrastructure for a democratic society. But apart from these two, every other Muslim country, every Muslim country in the world is undemocratic. And even if they have democratic government, they are in name only and very little in practice. So when a society is facing such acute social and political internal trouble, they don't have the space or the luxury to be able to practice peace and stability in their own neighborhood. Forget about the country at large. So when I speak to people in Iraq, they say to me, the mothers, when my children leave home every morning, I don't know whether they will return. I don't know whether I'll be receiving body parts in body bags. It's not in only Iraq, it's in Afghanistan. My parents come from Bangladesh, in Bangladesh too. So for as long as the Muslim world is unstable and have no legitimate government, no legitimate authority, no prospect of better future, unfortunately the world will be in turmoil for years to come. Who is responsible for the instabilities in the Muslim world? Of course, the Muslims themselves. But we also have to take our fair share of the blame for the troubles that we cause. Let me give you an example. I'm not sure if Norway has been party to this, but let's give you an example. A few years ago, 2 years ago, in Egypt, Egyptian people held an election, didn't they? After 100 years, or actually 800 years, they say. First ever free and fair election in Egypt. That saw a government being put together and a president from Muslim Brotherhood as an organization. We don't like Muslim Brotherhood in the West. We don't like an Islamic government to rule Egypt. So what did we do? We gave wink and nod to the military general saying, go ahead. You go ahead, do something about it. So with our support, General Sisi overthrew an elected government. And he became the dictator and then the president. Elected government only got 60%, 65% of the total population's vote to become legitimate, 65%. General Sisi got 97.5% of the total vote in his approval as the president. And guess what we did last month? America and the European Union approved sending arms consignment to General Sisi. What does he do with the arms that we supply him? He suppresses the opposition leaders, puts them in prison, and tries them in military court, arbitrarily hangs them, shoots them, kills them. He subjugates his population, and we stay silent about it because it serves our interest. Remember I told you it would be uncomfortable, but I'm telling the truth. I don't like this. If we are going to be promoters of democracy and freedom and rule of law, we should promote democracy and freedom across the board to everybody. I don't want our government, British government, to be in bed with the Saudi government. Because Saudi government violates more human rights than any other government in the world. Saudi government, they do. Whether you're a Muslim or non-Muslim, it makes no difference. They violate human rights of everybody except their royal family. I don't want our government to be in bed with the Egyptian dictator. I don't want our government to be in bed with the dictators of Bangladesh and Pakistan. But our government is constantly in bed with those people. How can we then blame the defenseless, the armless, the resourceless masses of Muslims who are trying to be free? How can we blame them? When the Egyptian masses came out into the street, what happened? 150,000 Egyptians are rotting in jail today under General Sisi. 150,000 Egyptians are rotting in jail. What is their crime? They opposed General Sisi. And what did he use to subjugate them? Our weapons. British military aid, I'm going to tell you this, British military experts went to General Sisi to provide him and his security services training as to how to manage crowd and demonstrations. Sold them weapons, taser guns, tear gas, and many other sophisticated weaponry. So when we ask ourselves, why are there so many, why do we have so much trouble in the Muslim world? I blame the Muslims first. I blame the Muslims first, without a shadow of a doubt. I say Muslims have caused it. But I can't ignore our role in all of this. I can't ignore it. And you can't ignore it either. And if we remain hypocritical about it, just like the Mediterranean has become the graveyard for the poor people of Africa, it makes me cry again. It wasn't that long ago, the same Mediterranean saw many black men and women being overthrown from the slave ships that were transporting them from Africa to Europe and America. It was that Mediterranean that's become the graveyard of the desperate people of Africa wanting some opportunities of what we have in our continent called Europe. If it's not our foreign policies, what is it? If it's not our trade policies, what is it that is keeping Africa poor and us so rich? And do you know your GDP? Forget about your GDP. Do you know your surplus? How much you have in your bank account, in the government's coffers? You have reserves in trillions, not millions. Entire Africa can live on $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Entire Africa can live. And Norway has trillions of dollars in its reserve. What does Norway need trillions of dollars for? If the world is going to rot away, if the world is going to be burnt in Africa, believe you me, the smoke will affect this. You won't be able to protect yourself. So my honest answer to you is, we are all in trouble. My father used to tell me a good joke. He said, my son, I'll tell you a story. A man had head lice. You know head lice? Small insects that you get in children's head lice. He did not know how to get rid of it. So he decided, I had enough. I'm going to put fire on my child's hair. So he lit a fire and put it on the hair of the child. What happened? The child and the lice both got burned. If we are true about the world's trouble, we can't put fire on the head lice that's causing the trouble at the moment. We need to find shampoo, comb, and strategies that will help rid the world of head lice. And I'm saying the world's peace depends on our honest, consistent policies, our honest, consistent philosophy of sharing our wealth and our prosperity, and our honest and consistent approach to democracy for everybody. Otherwise, forget about it. There will be no peace.
Well, it's been a pleasure to listen to you and speak to you and have a conversation with you. But I think we also will open for some few questions from the audience if you have something to apply or ask or disagree or anything that you have in mind, you are free to speak out and say some questions. Yes.
Sorry, it's over. It's not a challenge anyone, and I respect every religion. And but concerning, I want to ask one question. But first of all, I just want to talk a little bit about Africa because it's one conversation as Imam has answered for Africa. I'm from Africa, and it's very painful to hear in one way because. These last days is very something very tragic happened in the Mediterranean, and but which because because I wonder richness in one country, if it's money or if it's resources. Because for me, one country is not be called rich because they have money. I mean cash. I mean in the bank. One country have to be called rich because they have resources, mineral on the ground. I mean, bauxite, gold, and everything, oil and everything. And for me, I come from Africa, and we are the poorest continent in the world, but in one way, I can say it's the richest continent in the world either, too, because they have everything what their countries need in one way, but they cannot use them because they don't know how to. And it's very difficult because me, I'm born in one Muslim family. I'm a Muslim, even I'm not practicing 100%, I agree. But I'm a Muslim and I'm not challenging anyone, but I'm thinking too much and I have a wife, Christian wife, I have one daughter. And but it's a bit difficult to think about the world now we are living now because we are living on one system who's separating us in one way. Because humanity is one. It's not true. We are all, we are the same. And but the system now is coming one system, political system, who's separating the countries and the people in one way, and is making anger inside the people, the heart of the people, and they're hating each other in one way. Because Islam now, he has a bad name because of the medias. Because no one is perfect in the earth. Doesn't matter, you are Buddhist, you are Christian, you are Muslim, no one is perfect. And everyone who make mistake, he's recorded by his mistake. But one Muslim, if he make mistake, he's called by the religion. And that is a bit painful to see, because they are taking the people who make mistakes, who killing some people, for example, and they are calling them for extremist Islamists, their own name. And in all the rest of the world, I see, if someone make, they are saying, this man make this mistake, and he have to be judged by his mistake. But my question was, is just about the science and the science, because I don't understand these two worlds. Because now the Western, we say Europe and America, the powerful continents, and they believe the science, in the science. And I don't know where the science comes from. Because as what I learned in Muslim, we believe in science in one way. Or I believe in science. In science, S-E-S-E-K-N-A-S, science. And that is the nature, because everything is created by God, as created in Islam. And that, we call this science. It's not science. I can take example for one, the Big Bang theory, in one way, the creation for the universe. And as if you are Muslim, you should know that before the science, the Quran, in one way, because that is in the Quran, in one way. But it's a bit painful to see, to talk about this, because he can be like a challenge, but it's not. It's just a wonder, this life we are now, the truth is not abdicate. Is we are hiding truth each other, and that is making more consequences than before, if you understand my word. And because the terrorism now is the main point in the medias. And for me, terrorism is not good. But the people who make terrorism, maybe they have some reasons to make it that. And why did the world give them that reason to make that terrorists in one way? And but I'm very happy to be here to hear about how we can connect together, because that is one of my worries, but I cannot do anything about it because I'm just a simple person. And I think the connection for the religions, we have to believe, because faith is belief. We have to first believe in one thing, in one way. And if we do, then we can go in one way. But it's a bit, my English is not so very good, and I'm sorry if I make mistake here, some language mistake. But,
no bad, thank you.
Yeah. But I'm very happy to be here to hear about, but I don't know how to come to the conclusion, because my wish is how we human beings, we can be in one, without hate, without, yeah. Thank you for me.
Thank you so much for your comment. Do you want to?
Let's take a question.
Yes, another question. Yes. Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to Norway. I am also invited from a Muslim friend of me in Moss, so I don't live here in this neighborhood. Thank you very much. You did talk about the education of children, also from 0 to 7 years, from 7 to 14 years. And you told that from 0 to 7 years, the brain was like a sponge. And you did learn your daughter words from the Quran. You didn't say anything more, but I did you learn anything more?
Of course.
What do you?
Very good point. I did, actually. I like I said, I teach them stories, I teach them morality, I teach them the life of the Prophet, I teach them the universal lessons that we have, I teach them science, I teach them geography, I teach them languages. We teach everything to them. So that's the reason why our children speak five languages. Otherwise, they would not be learning all of that if we don't spend enough time. And also, we home educate our children. They don't go to school. So we spend a huge amount of time in educating the children, the best of what we have around us, science and technology, etc. We believe that every child has a natural disposition, and we need to find out what is the best that they have and what are they good at, and nurture that skill rather than impose the one I think they should have. So in the Asian communities, we were constantly told to become doctors, engineers, lawyers, because they're professions that give you secure finance and secure future. I don't do that with our children. So we teach our children things that they're good at and nurture that skill with Islam and teachings of God and Quran and everything else that is around. Yes.
You did also talk about the seven attitudes. I know them very good. And that's also in the Buddhism.
Of course.
The same attitudes.
And I say it's universal.
I mean, these attitudes must be the most important moments, as the most key to keep a worthful life. And also, these attitudes must be the most best tools to build bridges between the religions. But to get this good integrated in me, I need self-insight. Therefore, I also need tools to work with my own, to build up a self-insight. That's also very difficult, but I don't ask you how you in the Islamic world try to contribute, get a better self-insight. Why, that is a condition for development. So, in this, at least, you talked about the program on TV, condition, Lynn Skåber, the journalist, in a relation to keep religion private or not, or in the public. I mean, I not agree with you. we keep good bridges, we should much more keep our religions in our private. We see most of the world wars in the world, 90% through it, has a religious background. In the 1600 years in Europe, we managed to divide politics from religion, and we got a calm time. So I think to keep the religion much more away from the public, the government, will be a tool to get more peace.
Can I ask you, I don't want to ask, but I want to just respond on two fronts. Number one, it is not true that most of the wars in the world has been caused by religion. It is not true factually, because if you do research and study, you find most of the wars have been caused by greed, hunger for power, thirst for power, and faith. Nothing to do with religion. So this is anti-religion. And in the modern time, more people have been killed as a result of secular wars than religious wars. I'll give you an example. First World War, Second World War, the bombings of Japan, the nuclear Hiroshima Nagasaki disaster, the Gulf War I, Gulf War II, Vietnam War, Cambodian War, wars in Laos, wars in South America. I can give you a list of wars in the last 100 years that have been fought, had nothing to do with religion, it had everything to do with secularity, in fact, muscular secularism, I call it, and everything to do with resources, had to do with money, and had to do with power. And it's not religion that is at fault. Second point to what you said earlier on, I understand you prefer religions to have private, to be kept in the private. That's your view. I respect your view. Majority of Norwegians believe it should not be private. So if we go by democratic principle of majority, majority would prefer it to be public. And I believe it's not just Norway. If there was an objective survey done across Europe, majority of Europeans would oppose religions being banished to the private. They would want religion to have a more important role to play in public. I believe this to be true. Here is a thesis given by a great scholar called Francis Fukuyama, who is an American media historian. He said, the media has the most powerful role to play in the modern world. Media can generate truth and it can create false consensus. I believe we're living at a time of media generating false consensus on issues of morality and religion. I believe majority of the media are owned by a few individuals whose own personal, political and financial interest override the collective interest of humanity. And therefore they don't care what you talk about when it comes to morality as long as money is made for it. And they deliberately create false consensus by regurgitating the same old rubbish left, right and center and creating you and I to believe that things that are wrong to be right, things that are false to be true. An example I'll give you. Egypt was an example I used before. In Egypt, when Morsi was in power, Egyptian media, 99% of them were owned still by Mubarak, the previous government, his friends and cronies. They still owned the media because they all got license from him. As soon as Morsi came to power, they vilified him every day. They talked against him, they said all sorts of good, bad and the ugly, factual and unfactual, including Morsi is responsible for switching off the gas in Egypt. Morsi is responsible for the electricity in Egypt. Morsi is responsible for the bread queue in Egypt. They made up all those stories. And people, en masse, believe them. Because that's what they hear 24 hours a day through their television screen. When media plays that role, guess what happens? People turned against Morsi at some stage. But the day Morsi was ousted from power, and when Sisi came to power, the very next day electricity was up. Gas was back in supply, and there was no bread queue in the bakery. I want to know who turned the tap off while Morsi was in power. I want to know who switched the grids off when Morsi was in power. So media plays a very destructive role, in my view, in the modern world, in creating this false consensus and creating in the world more immorality and saying to the world that the world is united on the new frontiers of morality. I reject that totally. I believe if there was free press, free objective analysis, we would find something very different. And just to go back to my African friend, which country do you come from?
I'm from Guinness.
Guinness, thank you very much. I tell you, I am 100% with you that the colonial project left the world divided into small chunks and countries, arbitrarily drawing a line on the sand and paper to divide nations and people based on those who would serve our best colonial interest. That is the problem of the world today. The world as it is divided, the nation states as we see today, is artificial, especially in the poorest parts of the world, especially in Africa and Asia, artificial in the Middle East, artificial in every way possible. And for as long as we keep people artificially divided and forcefully united, we'll see problems and troubles. So I want to see us going back and say we want to create a new world in which we have an inclusive narrative of all of us being equal. We have a powerful role to play in creating a better world together. That will take a long time, but that starts by conversations like this. An honest conversation in a space that is religious and free. I have no problem with that. It's safe space. It's being led by a faith community. The more of this we do, the more likely we'll wake up the masses to see the need of creating a new narrative. That's what's needed.
And I really think that should be the finish line. Because I know there's a lot of questions out there, but I see our time is running up. So I'm afraid we have to come to an end and bring the discussion, sort of discussion there. I want to say thank you so much for sharing this this Sunday with us, both in church and also here in this this control afterwards. And you have made us, enlightened us in so many ways to continue talk about these issues. And I think this congregation here at the R has learned something today, and we can just work with these questions further. And I wanted to give you something for sharing this this day with us. And when you get new friends, you want them to come back. And I really want you to come back. And I think I had bought a gift that had to make you come back here one day. So, I actually bought you a fishing rod. I don't know if you see much of Norway, but we have all the lovely fjords and sea and oceans.
When our friend Mawash wrote to me 2 days ago, what would you like to do?
Yes.
Do you know what I wrote at my first? Fishing.
Oh, really? Perfect. Then this is
I'm not coming to the center tonight. I'm going fishing.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, I know you are a long wildlife, so this is a blessing from us. I hope it takes you suitcase. And I also want to say a big thank you to Toril Østmo, who have been helping out with this this day, and also Mawash, guys. Thank you so much for arranging this this day. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed coming to the church today.
Mawash.
Tusen takk for at
jeg
fikk lov til å komme igjen. Ja, nå fortsatt to igjen. Tredje gang. Alle gode ting er tre. Takk for at jeg fikk lov til å komme til kirken og overveie seremonien. Og tusen takk for at dere ønsket å ta imot imamen. Og at dere var så vokale til å ta imot dette temaet for dagen. Og hvis dere enda mer vokale, så dere hjertelig velkommen til Litteraturhuset på tirsdag. Hvor temaet har islam en plass i Europa? Hva svaret? Det vet vi ikke. Men det så vi kan imamen til å hjelpe oss å svare. Dere hjertelig velkomne. Tusen takk.
Ja, det er det. 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 Ja, det er det.